right, friends, Greg Kokel here in Stand to Reason. I want to welcome you to the show. I'm feeling a little bit, what is the right word? Pensive, thoughtful, anguished, I guess. These are all words that would apply right now, because I want to talk with you about something this first 20 minutes or so that is really painful for me to talk about. In fact, it's so painful and fraught, I think, with pitfalls that I've asked Amy Hall to join me because Amy, thank you for being willing to do this.
You're welcome.
She's really thrilled about being here. It's because we are both anguished by something that we need to talk about to provide some perspective and in a certain sense, a way forward. And there are, like I said, there are kind of pitfalls regarding this conversation that is the reason that I wanted Amy on board, just to help me clarify for you some things that may be misunderstood by the way I explained them. And Amy and I have talked about these particular issues a lot, and so we understand each other, and I think she'll be a help to me in that regard. It is now fairly common knowledge, since the internet has been ablaze, especially the last week or so, with this information, that Ravi Zacharias, who is I think it's safe to say, has been a spiritual hero to multitudes of people around the globe, has for years had, I should say, for years been living a kind of a secret life of sexual immorality, of spiritual deceit, and of professional duplicity. These issues emerged maybe 3 years ago, and he was able to convince people that the rumors were not true, and they moved forward. And since Ravi died in May of last year, a whole bunch of new information has come forward, which necessitated the organization to do a full kind of analysis. And they hired a legal team to do that and gave them free rein to find out the truth. And they have just published their report that tells everything that they discovered. And it's not a pretty picture. And it is hard to imagine, Amy, I think, anything so unsettling as learning that a person of such influence has fallen as far as he did and as hard as he did. And really, it kind of knocks the wind out of us.
It's totally disorienting, Greg, to have your image of somebody, your understanding of somebody. And people feel like they know people that they listen to all the time. So to find out they were completely wrong about that is so disorienting. Mm-hmm.
So it also gives an ugly opportunity to our critics. And it leaves a lot of people really angry, I guess, to put it simply. And this is what I'm struggling myself with, my own my own shock. I'll qualify that in just a few minutes, and my anger because of the damage that has been left in the wake of the discovery of this pattern, long-term pattern of behavior of Ravi Zacharias. And so what I want to do here, Amy, and we've talked about this as a staff, and you and I have discussed these things too, I don't want to add fuel to the fire of the issue itself. This is out in the open, thoroughly now. The complete report has been made public. RZIM leadership has offered a published an open letter of profound repentance and apology for their myopia, that is their short-sightedness. There's no indication that I can see that they were complicit in any of this. But they were myopic. They were short-sighted. There was evidence in the table that they might have pursued more aggressively than they had. But I'm not pointing fingers. I'm just saying this is the nature of their apology, which is very thoroughgoing. We are not at Stand to Reason going to post the report, and I'll tell you why in just a moment. We will post the apology because it's good to read, and it's not salacious. It's a heartfelt acknowledgement of a certain measure of responsibility here and a desire to put things right. So I think you should read it. But what I'd like to do, Amy, is I know that there are people who are stunned like we are and shocked and shaken. And they don't know what to think. We've both been getting emails from friends. How do we process this? How do we even start? And so what I thought I'd do is try to put together a handful of principles, maybe you could call them, that might help people navigate the trauma of this discovery, because it is traumatic. And these are things that we've talked about, and actually, you want to know how I deal with this? This is what I'm telling you. Okay, so Amy, this first one, I'm most concerned about this first one because I think it's the most easy to misunderstand. And I'm going to ask you to help me out after I talk a little bit about this. But I'm also telling you, my listeners, that I don't want to be misunderstood here. I'm trying to lay some balance out. So be charitable in the way you assess what I have to say. You may disagree with it, and that's okay if you do. The first principle that I have, and this, again, I think this is going to be the most controversial thing that I'm going to say, is to steer clear of the details. I'm talking to you who know about the problem, that which has been exposed, revealed, that's different than getting into the salacious details, which, for example, are part of the legal report, which is why I don't want to post it. And years ago, I made a decision. And the decision was, I mean, I'm 48 years a Christian, so I've seen scandals come down the pike. And I made a decision that I am not going to get into those things unless I'm a principal in those things. If I'm a player, if I have an important role to play in resolving the issue, then I'm going to do what I can do to resolve it. But if I don't have a need to know the details, I don't want to know those details. And Amy, you know, when I read through Proverbs, and I do frequently, there is a proverb that has stood out for me as being relevant here. And there Solomon says, you know, the words of a whisperer are like dainty morsels, and they go deep down into the heart of a man. And I think the point seems obvious to me. When you hear vile things about another person, even if they're true, those things stick. And whenever you think of that other person, that's what you think about. Now, in this particular case, there was a necessity for the public to know what happened, at least in general. And I think that's completely appropriate. However, getting into the gnarly details is not necessary to know what to be able to assess the circumstances as has been done. All right. When you dig in dirt, you get dirty. I do not want your soul to be soiled with the knowledge of the particulars. There is an appeal to that. You know, it's like slowing down for an accident on the freeway or whatever. However, I do not think it will serve you well. If you haven't read the report, my recommendation to you is not to read it. I'm giving you, I think, as much detail as you need to know about the circumstance. Further talk about it, further pursuit of it, I don't think is going to help. Paul's counsel, be wise in what is good and innocent in what is evil. So I think the less talk there is, the less damage. You know, Proverbs also says, where there are many words, transgression is unavoidable. There's a lot of talk about this. And frankly, there's a lot of finger pointing going on. Amy, you mentioned to me, or as we discussed this earlier, how difficult it is to get enough relevant information to be able to judge certain circumstances. That isn't a question with regards to Ravi in this case, because we have that information. But there does seem to be a lot of finger pointing going on. I thought it was really helpful when you said that.
Yeah, we don't know. I mean, obviously, you're right. We know that what Ravi did was terrible, and we have that information. What we don't know is exactly how RZIM responded, whether, you know, obviously, like you said before, there were things they could have pursued that they didn't pursue. And but I think there's a big difference between saying they were covering up something versus they were being naive and not doing their due diligence. I think those are two different things, and I don't have enough information to know which was happening. Right. But I assume the people closer will bring that out. But for now, I just to respond to what you were saying about not knowing the details, I just want to reiterate that you're not saying, you're advocating hiding this up or sweeping it under the rug.
Right.
There's knowledge of what happened in the main, and then there's the details of every incident and all those things. And I think that's what you're saying, Greg, that we don't need, like the people on the street, like we don't need to know that. You read the report. I read the report just because people will be asking me about it and wanting my opinion. And
we have a peculiar role in the lives of people mm-hmm. who are listening, for example. And so of necessity, we had to be more informed. But I don't know about you. You haven't weighed in on this. But when I read the Christianity Today article, well, I saw it. I didn't read the whole thing. I just got a little bit. I didn't want to. And then I had to read it. And then I read the report. And frankly, I felt soiled afterwards. I don't want others to feel that way when they don't need to. That's what I'm trying to protect them from.
Right. And so it's not what you're not saying, and this is what I want to make sure people don't hear you say, is that you're not saying that you're trying to protect your soul at the expense of the victims. That's not yes. what we're saying. The everything has been exposed, and we're all decrying what happened, but knowing every detail is a different matter. That's what you're saying, right, Greg?
Yeah, and I just think there's just a lot of talk about this now that I am not convinced is helpful. The issue of the victims are being addressed by RZIM, and they have issued a very thoroughgoing apology. And as you'll be able to see if you check the statement, and we will post that. And I didn't want this to be so much now about RZIM, but about the broader issue, because there's going to be other times when these things come up. And I want you to be protected from all of the shameful details that does not help you to know about. Amy, you had a verse that you cited from Ephesians, was it?
Oh, Ephesians 5, 11 through 13. Do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead even expose them. For it is disgraceful even to speak of the things which are done by them in secret.
Mm-hmm. There's an interesting contrast there, and it really is what I'm after here. And on the one hand, these are don't participate in awful deeds, but rather expose them. So there's a propriety to exposing them. We don't cover it up. We don't ignore the victims. We expose it. However, the things that end up having to be exposed in general have details that are so awful that it is shameful even to speak of these things. And I think this is where Paul is saying, like I'm saying, the details, that kind of stuff, you know, that's shameful. So you don't expose it, but you don't need to get into the dirt and soil yourself or your mind or your soul in the process. And that's all I'm saying here, basically.
Greg, I
don't go ahead.
You go ahead, Greg. Sorry.
I was going to say, trying to sum this last point up is don't speak more than you need to expose the details or something to that effect. You know, you find out what you need to do, the exposing that Paul talks about, but you don't need to stir up the salacious details that are shameful to even talk about.
And just to reiterate again, Greg's not talking about the principles involved. Obviously, they need to know the details. They need to deal with exposing those, with helping the victims, with all those sorts of things. So it's just a question of wisdom of how much you want to know about that, or how much you should know about that when you're not involved
right.
in the situation.
Yeah. And so my advice then, just to sum it up for this first point, is that now you know there was this problem, this terrible thing that is being dealt with by the principals and those involved, and let it go. Let's move on. And in fact, I have no intention of talking about this anymore on this show after today. Okay. I'm going to cover the bases as best I know in terms of the principles involved, and then we're moving on. More talk leads to just more trouble, I think. All right. So here's the second point that I have, and this, you know, may be really obvious to some people, and that is, don't be surprised when sinners sin. Now, I want to be careful how I say this, because in this case, the sin was egregious. But when a Christian icon tumbles for me, and a number of them have tumbled in the last 50 years, I may be shocked, but I'm not shaken, because I'm not surprised about what human beings are capable of doing. And I noted a long time ago, Amy, in John chapter 2, Jesus is kind of first introduced, and he gets a very favorable reception. People really like him. They're fired up, and many were believing in it. It's interesting what John records, but Jesus was not entrusting himself to any of them because he knew what was in man. He understood human, fallen human nature, and that people are fickle, and they can be one way one day and one way or another. And this is something we have to remind ourselves of. We know fallen human nature too, if we take our Bibles seriously, and that sin crouches at the door of every one of us, even the so-called greatest among us. We're all vulnerable. We're all capable. And if we're not vigilant and on our guard, we can also be assaulted by sin. So on the one hand, it's clearly not consistent with the Christian life to live a life of ongoing immorality. However, that people can do that, even people we expected better of, is consistent with our worldview. It's sinners sin. And though, as I said, we can be shocked, I encourage people not to be shaken by it. I mean, only Christ is good, right? And in Galatians 6, Paul even warned the spiritual Christians who he is helping to know how to correct people who have fallen into sin. You who are spiritual, restore such a one. And then he says, this warning, note it, looking to yourselves, lest you also be tempted. And so Paul was aware that even the spiritual leadership is capable of falling, and was offering a warning regarding that. Amy, any thoughts?
This is really tough, because I think there's I don't want us to expect that Christians are going to live a lifestyle of sin. And you touched on this, Greg. That shouldn't be our expectations. But sometimes people are, this is such a difficult topic. It's Greg. And the reason why this is so hard is because, again, I don't think anyone is going to get their response in this exactly right. So again, I just ask for grace for everybody as we're trying to work through all these things. Mm-hmm. I don't want to ever say that I expect to find Christians living a lifestyle of deception and sin and all these things. And I don't think we should expect that. But you're right that we will see sin. I mean, I've seen all sorts of levels of Christians sinning. And I think of 1 John, and I think about how there's that distinction is made. You know, there are, when you sin, when you fall into sin, there is a sacrifice for you in Christ, and, mm-hmm. and you turn to Him. And at the same time, he's talking about how there are those who are not of us, and there are those who are, this is how you recognize false teachers, is if they are living a lifestyle of, you know, continual sin. So I think there are so many ways, Greg, where there are so many distinctions to be made here and so many things to think through mm-hmm. that, you know, we're never going to cover this all in 20 minutes. So I just, these are just things to like start thinking about, mm-hmm. about this topic.
Yeah, that's a good qualification. Here's a third thing that I think is going to be helpful for some, especially those who have benefited greatly from a fallen leader's instruction or teaching. And this is also a warning to critics who want to take advantage of this circumstance to put down Christianity because of the failure of the Christian. And the point I'm making here is that truth is still true, all right? And it's tempting and understandable for especially outsiders to denigrate Christianity because of the failings of the believer. But though it's understandable, it's a false move. Even though the witness may be sullied, so to speak, the truth that had been taught is not nullified. Now, here I want to be really careful because I don't, Amy, mean to be suggesting that we continue to exalt the person who has done badly because there are things that the person said that were good. What I'm trying to rescue our friends from is feeling bad because an individual Christian leader had helped them with true things that were taught sometime in the past. And those true things that were taught that helped you are still true. Now, this doesn't mean we continue to recommend the writings or books of that leader or whatever. I mean, that creates other problems. But to the critic on the outside, it doesn't mean that Christianity is false either. I mean, there is nothing about our convictions regarding God or salvation that rests on the shoulders of any human being save for Jesus of Nazareth. And therefore, whatever is true about Christianity is just as true after a moral defeat as it was before.
That's true, Greg.
Okay.
I mean, what's interesting is you're right. I've gotten a bunch of questions about this, and they're always this, you know, he was such a mentor to me. Now, how do I make sense of that?
Yeah.
And I think the way you make sense of it is he said true things regardless of where he was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Objective
that
truth
God
is
used.
Yeah. Objective that truth God is used, objective right. truth.
Right. And God can use the truth coming from anyone. I mean, this is, you know, this shows the divine power to accomplish noble ends through ignoble means. And I think both are true here. No one's immorality invalidates truth, all right? Here's another concern that I have, and this was, you know, you mentioned something to me a while back, you know, about who do we trust, you know, now? Mm-hmm. And I think there are a lot of people who are asking that question. And I think, and my warning is this, guard yourself from becoming cynical. And I think that the temptation is strong to kind of cast a jaundiced eye towards other Christian leaders, wondering what secrets they may be hiding, you know, and don't do that. Don't allow the failure of an individual or a few individuals to cause you to be suspicious of the many who, you know, I'm completely convinced are living noble lives and serving the Lord with honor. So in response to the question, who can I trust? My answer is very simple. And this is what I said to you when this came up in our earlier conversation, Amy. You trust everyone that you have no reason to mistrust, which, as it turns out, is most people you know, maybe just about everybody you know. Now, are we going to be wrong sometimes? Yes, but I think rarely. That's the exception, not the rule, because the vast multitudes of spiritual leaders are living, as I said, noble lives, and that we think of them charitably when we have no reason to think otherwise, I think is actually a virtue. I think it's a healthy habit.
Yeah, and as you're talking, Greg, I'm thinking about there's a wide range of sin that we will see in sinners. Okay, so there's a level of sin that you're going to find in every single leader because we're fallen people. And so I think having that kind of understanding will help two things. Number one, it will help you to be wise about maybe holding yourself accountable or putting you in situations where other people are going to hold you accountable.
Mm-hmm.
And in making sure that your leaders, say in your church, the one that you're connected to, are in a position where they're being held accountable. So being aware that that's a reality, sin is a reality, that's something that we can do. But also understanding that sin is there, you can have grace for them. So I would not assume when you encounter sin in your leaders at your church immediately that means that they can't even be your leaders anymore. I guess I'm just saying, Greg, there is a wide range of sin. And so I know, again, this is so difficult to think about, but
these are the pitfalls I was talking about, because it's hard to give recommendations without being misunderstood and maybe right. Overgeneralizing and stuff like that. Go ahead.
So anyway, I can't even remember what is your main point here, Greg, again, just so I can get back on track.
Well, I'm not becoming cynical.
Yes, right. So there's a difference between being cynical and being realistic about the fact that everyone is fallen. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah. Not cynical, but sober-minded here.
Yeah.
And I think that I think it's healthy to have heroes. And what I would hate to see is a kind of cynicism set into somebody's life that they never risk looking up to anybody anymore. It's healthy to have heroes. It's healthy to have people that we do look up to because we want to emulate their lives or their virtues or whatever. But it is not healthy to expect too much of them. And I think that's where the balance comes in.
That sounds good, Greg.
This is another one, Amy, that may be misunderstood, so I'm not going to say a lot about it. I'm just going to try to make this general appeal. And this is because when a leader falls, it has ramifications for those around him that are professionally associated with them. And those are people that, like we were saying a moment ago, are probably noble, virtuous people serving the Lord in a powerful way. And my recommendation here then is to try to keep the worker distinct from the work. All right? Let me just say it again. Try to keep the worker, the fallen worker in this case, distinct from the work. The organization's fallen leaders serve may still be and have hopefully continue to be fruitful expressions of the kingdom of God on earth. And the unfortunate thing is one bad man can bring an otherwise good organization to its knees. And I just want to encourage you to make the distinction between the two, because the worker can be bad, but the work of God can be good and noble and sound and worthy of our, our prayers and our hopes that they rise from the ashes, so to speak. And that's my desire in this circumstance. But I don't know, do you have anything else you want to offer, just to maybe offer some clarification on that point, Amy?
On that particular point?
Yeah.
Well, you're not saying that people should continue in their work, that we should make a distinction. Let's say it was somebody who was found to be, obviously this doesn't apply to Ravi because he's gone, but if someone were found to be living a double life, now you're not saying that we should make a distinction between his work and his sin and allow him to go on.
No, that's not all. I'm all that set aside. I'm talking about those around him who are serving faithfully and nobly in a work of God that has made, for years, has been making a powerful impact in the world. That's still legitimate and noble, even though a major player, even a founding player, is discredited the way he has been. And again, I don't want to make this so much about the Ravi, but as a more of a general principle to keep in mind, that though it certainly has application here, and because we don't want there to be more damage than is necessary, I guess is what I'm saying here. And there are lots of people associated with that organization that have done wonderful, wonderful work. In fact, the organization, and I'm convinced, is the work of God. Now, if the organization is actively complicit in the behaviors, that's a different story. Okay, I have no reason to think that's the case here, but people have different opinions. But I just want to make this distinction so you can be thinking about that, the difference between the worker and the work. I mean the larger organization and the work that God has accomplished through them and by his grace will continue to accomplish. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So I know we have some callers on board. Amy's got to go and get them. I've got one more thought to offer, maybe one and a half more thoughts, but it's not, this last thing is something that's we agree on clearly, this last principle. So I'm going to let Amy go.
Let me just say one last quick thing, and that is
parting shot.
I think we're all really grateful that the truth has come out. We're all really grateful that the victims have been heard. We're all really grateful that the truth is known, and I just want to be clear about that. And
I agree.
Truth is important, and rebuking evil is important. And may we all be on the side of truth.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Well done, Amy. Thank you for your help. Here's my last really parting salvo, resolve it for yourselves. And I'm speaking autobiographically here as well. To finish well. To finish well. I frequently think of the words of Jesus in, I think it's Matthew 25, speaking to the sheep and saying, well done, good and faithful servant. This is what I want to hear. I want to hear those words. I remember maybe 10 years ago now, riding in a van with J.P. Moreland and Bill Craig and Craig Hazen, I think, was there. Maybe Gary Habermas. We were all getting picked up from San Francisco Airport and trucked into the Central Valley in California for a big event. And so we had a couple of hours to spend together in the car. And J.P. was just rousing the troops a little bit in a really good way. And he was reflecting how God had been using us in significant ways, but his exhortation was, let's finish the course. Let's finish well. Listen, guys, we only got another 15 or 20 years. That's it. We've been lasted all this time. Let's just hang in there and finish well. And it's good advice. When you see people that don't finish well, make it your intention to not be like that. Resolve to finish the course well. And this, of course, can only be done by God's grace, manifest through the body of Christ and brothers and sisters, like JP was there, cheering us on, keeping us accountable, keeping watch over us when we're caught in a trespass, being corrected with gentleness, looking to yourselves, lest you also be tempted, as Paul said. So that's my final principle. I mean, what I've offered is that please don't get yourself into the dirt and the mud with the details if you can possibly avoid it. Don't soil yourself with that stuff. Let the principles take care of things, and it looks like that's being taken care of in this particular case. Don't be surprised when sinners sin, sometimes really badly. It is shocking. It's not what we expect from Christians, but it does happen. The truth is still the truth, regardless. Guard yourself from becoming cynical. Trust people who we have every reason to trust, okay? Distinguish between the fallen worker and the work of God that they may have been part of, which still can persist by his grace and finish well. I want to answer one last question here very quickly, or at least respond to one. And we keep getting emails, and I got one yesterday from a friend. Do you think that Robbie was saved? It is a natural question for everyone to ask. And I will tell you how I answer that. I don't answer it. For myself, I don't. And the reason is because neither answer to that question makes any sense to me. It is a total conundrum. Now, you may not share my view, which is all right. You may have very strong convictions about this, which is all right. I'm not going to gainsay them. But I think there's a lot of you out there that are wondering about the answer to that question, and I am just letting you know it's okay not to answer that question. You can be free of that question. That's God's business. All right? Some people are not going to like me saying that. Well, that's fine. But for myself, that's my solution. I'm just going to let it go. I'm not going to pursue that. I'm not going to think about it. I can't answer that. So I hope my thoughts were helpful, especially in this very difficult time. And now I'm happy to leave this issue behind and to press forward in the upward call of Christ Jesus and the things that he has for us to do. All right? Let's take a break, and then we'll come back for your calls on Stand to Reason. Friends, if you like this broadcast, I know you'll love hashtag STRAsk. It's our shorter 20-minute podcast where I am paired with the wonderful Amy Hall, and together we answer the questions you send us on Twitter. Hashtag STRAsk is released twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, and it's only about 20 minutes long, so it's perfect to listen to on your morning jog or while driving around running errands or cleaning your garage or just plain loafing at home. Amy and I tackle your questions on theology and ethics and culture and lots more, offering our insight on the questions you're asking or the challenges you face. You can listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your own shows. Just remember, send us your questions on Twitter using the name of the podcast, hashtag STRAsk. That's hashtag STRAsk.
Have you ever wondered how Stand to Reason is able to produce fresh, accessible content each week? We rely on generous donors so that we can provide you with the tools and tactics you need to be an effective ambassador for Christ. If you've benefited from this podcast or any of our donor-provided resources, including our apps, blog posts, articles, and short videos, consider making a financial contribution to Stand to Reason today. Just visit str.org/donate to show your financial support. It has been an honor providing you with a host of free resources for more than 27 years to help you give voice to the Christian worldview. Help us continue by making a financial gift today at str.org/donate.
Just a heads up here, if you are a regular listener, and I hope you are, I think you need to get our monthly training material. We send it out for free, and I've often said that many things are caught more than they're taught, right? And listening to the show helps you catch them, as it were, as I work through issues with callers, and you kind of get the flow of things. But some things are taught, and this is why we send out things like Solid Ground, our bi-monthly article that I usually write. Sometimes I co-author it with other of my young guns here at Stand to Reason. And then on alternate months, there's a one-page mentoring letter that I send out. And each of these are designed to help you grow as an ambassador for Christ. But we need to know who you are and where you live, or at least what your email is, in order to send this out to you. And it's very easy. Just go to str.org. And I think in the upper right-hand corner, there's a subscribe button. And if you go all the way to the bottom of the page in the lower left-hand, there's a place where you can subscribe. It's all really there. It's very, very easy. And not only will you get the Solid Ground and the mentoring letters, but you'll also get some short videos from us, some blog highlights, and other things that we think will be helpful as the month goes forward. So go to str.org and sign up for that stuff. I highly recommend that material. I'm chuckling because it's it includes my work, so I still recommend it. I wouldn't be doing it if I couldn't recommend it. All right. Let's. I'm going to give the rest of the show to the callers here. And first on board is my buddy, Mr. Cade, from Hibbing, Minnesota. I want to call it the Rust Belt, but you call it the Iron Belt. Is that right?
Iron Range.
The Iron Range. Okay.
Iron Range.
So good to talk to you again, Cade.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you.
So what's been on my mind, I've actually been thinking about for a few months, and it kind of requires a short backstory.
Okay.
So back in November, actually, I was at the second reality conference I've been to.
Right.
So when I got there, I went to the book table because I just like books. But anyway, I went to the book table and I saw Jeff Meyer's book, Unquestioned Answers, there.
Right.
It kind of caught my eye. And so I look at the back, and what it does is it covers a lot of like Christian like slogans, like just have faith, or the Bible says it, so you should believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the book because I grew up with that quite a bit. I went to a Christian school, I went to a church, but I grew up with, we were told to believe it, but we never were really taught to believe it. And I can see how it's affected some of my sure. classmates that I used to go to school with.
By the way, that is a great distinction. I was told to believe it, but I wasn't taught to believe it. You should write that down, and I'll tell you why in a few moments. Go ahead.
Okay, sounds good. And so a few weeks later, I thought, what if somebody could write something for somebody my age? That I wish I would have had when I was looking for answers.
And let our listeners know how old you are.
13. So what I'm thinking as an age range is about around, like a teenage years.
Right, yeah. Well, my daughter's 13, so you're just starting your teenage year. But I'll tell you, you are capable beyond your years, in my view. I'm glad you're thinking about doing this. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Kokel. But so, as I was saying, I thought maybe it would be, I thought maybe it's needed to write a book. And I kind of wrestled with the idea at first. I'm like, do I really want to do this? Because I know how much work goes into something like that. But I kind of just felt a pressing on my heart. But I kept looking for places to go to find information. Like I even contacted people like Sean McDowell. But I haven't really found any way to get a process. So I have a few specific questions.
Okay.
But just in general, I'd really like a direction to go.
Mm-hmm.
So like the first question I have is really, where would I start?
All right. So what I'm going to share with you now in response to your questions are some basic things that I think are important for somebody kind of breaking into writing, for other people to read and benefit from. And by the way, that's really important. Some people write for themselves, but you want to write for others, and that changes the dimensions considerably, okay? You want to write for yourself, write whatever you want. Stephen King calls it writing with the door closed. When you're writing for somebody else, you got to write with the door open. That means other people got to look at it and critique it and say, this works, this doesn't work. So just that distinction. I have one rule that I have for writing is I never start with nothing. I know that sounds really weird, but whatever it is that I think I want to write on, this is something, Scott, I have to have been thinking about for a while and gathering little pieces of information that I think are relevant to the topic. Okay, so maybe I'll hear somebody say something. I'm thinking about this thing, and then I have some thoughts, and so then I write them down and I save them. And I hear some speaker, and then a citation I get, or I read something in a book that I said this is relevant or whatever. I try to never lose a good thought. Okay.
Okay.
Now, perfect example just happened a few moments ago. What you said is you said, I was told to believe these things, but I was never taught to believe these things. Now, that's a line that could go into an introduction of the kind of book that you're thinking about writing. And that's why I said, you know, write that down, keep that line. That's something you're going to throw into a file somewhere. I drive along and I think of something, and I'm going to hit my record on my phone and send myself an email, you know. And as I'm driving, you know, with the hands free type deal, I'm hands on the steering wheel, not on the phone, and I'm dictating into an email to myself these thoughts that I'm having, you know, because I don't want to forget that thing that just came to mind.
Yeah.
So chances are, if you were explaining again your circumstances, you wouldn't say, I was told to believe but not taught to believe. I mean, lightning rarely strikes twice like that.
Yeah.
So you don't want to lose the thought. That is a beautiful thought. It is cogent. It's crisp. It's memorable. That's the kind of thing you want to save. And so for me, when I start thinking about a larger project, I write stuff down, all right?
Okay.
Now, there's two kinds of things you're going to be writing down. One is going to be the broad ideas for your book. Well, here's what I want this book to accomplish. It'll cover this and this and this kind of fashion. So you're just stream of consciousness writing stuff down, helping to formulate your ideas of what you want to accomplish.
Okay.
And then there may be things that you are talking with somebody else about. And this happens with me a lot. That is, I'm talking with somebody else about a topic, and the thing comes out just like it did for you a few moments ago. And I think, oh, man, that's just the way I want to say it, you know. If I'm just sitting trying to think up stuff, it's harder than if I'm talking with somebody about it, and then it just comes out. And so it's not unusual for me, even standing before an audience, to say something that I think is well put for what I'm trying to communicate. And I'll say, hold on a minute. I got to write that down. I never said it like that before, and I don't want to lose it. And I write it in the margin of my notes, and then I continue on. So we have a little funny moment. But notice how I don't start when I'm starting a project, I'm not starting with a blank sheet of paper. All right.
Yeah.
I'm starting with a bunch of stuff that I have been collecting, and I collect it by never losing a thought that I think is valuable or important.
And I like that. And I feel like I started to do that, because what I did is, from all the information I've kind of compiled and some of the stuff that I found useful for what I'm trying to accomplish, I wrote it all down and I have an outline done. So
good. That's great. That's structuring. Now you're starting to structure, and structuring is really, really important. I think it's one of the biggest tasks. You get your information, you got to structure it, and then you got to wordsmith it. So that's good. I think you're moving forward well. And what you're going to try to decide here, as you're gathering information, you're trying to decide, do I have enough information to be able to write a piece, write a book of some length that will be helpful to other people? That's what you're trying to decide.
Yeah. So, okay. So my second question is then, one of the things I want the book to be simple, because I acknowledge sometimes I tend to fly off and not exactly know that I'm talking way over somebody's head.
Uh-huh.
So in this case, and to the audience I'm writing, they are not going to be acquainted with a lot of the terms. Like,
Right. Let's
just, for example, cosmological argument, irreducible mm-hmm. complexity, da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Right, right.
So I want to have it simple enough where they can understand it, but I want to have it complex enough, like I'm not, it doesn't sound like a book for an 8-year-old, or even if somebody wanted to pick my book up for, like, just to get started, get their toes wet.
Mm-hmm.
I want it to be able to cover that too. So mm-hmm. how do I write to the proper audience? How do I make my book sound like? It's hard to explain.
I'm following you, I think, and the answer is this is part of the craft. It isn't like there's just a simple answer for this. The general way of approaching problems like this is you first get the information down. In other words, write out, even if it's in cumbersome, complicated language, write out your points. Get your narrative down, so to speak. Get your flow of thought down, okay? Then when you come back and wordsmith the material, then you can worry about whether you're communicating well or not, okay? Now, the reason I say it this way is some people are sitting... There's a movie about a writer, which was goofy. It was a fun movie. It's called Throw Mom Off the Train. But the writer wasn't doing writing the way writers write. He's starting with a blank piece of paper, and he's trying to get the first sentence perfect. That's goofy. You can't do that. What you do is you get all the bunch of stuff down, and then you start to wordsmith it after you've got the substance down, okay? So okay. If you want to talk about the cosmological argument, just go ahead and write whatever you want to write and structure it the way you want to say it, okay? Then you can ask yourself, okay, how can I take these sentences now and youthitize them, I think is the way Brett Kunkel used to call it. Make it accessible to youth. Okay. And one way to do it is try to think about talking to an 8-year-old. How would you explain this to an 8-year-old in a way that would make sense to an 8-year-old? And I guarantee you, by the way, if you do that and explain it so that an 8-year-old could understand it, an adult will be able to understand it too. So
okay.
You kind of, in a certain strange sense, you hit both targets at once. You know, you can write with a kind of a simple clarity that a youngster could understand, well, then older folk are going to appreciate that too. But I will tell you this, that is part of the craft. That is part of the labor.
All audiences.
Well, it's more how do I communicate with simplicity and clarity to whatever audience that I'm speaking to.
Okay.
So I think you should be thinking about your younger audience. I'm just simply saying that if you can communicate clearly with the 8-year-old, whatever you say to the 8-year-old, an adult is going to understand too.
Yeah.
So you indirectly hit two targets at the same time. But your focus is the youngster, the younger group, because that's the market need that you're aware of and that you want to write to. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then another thing, touching on that topic, I'm still kind of new to apologetics myself, but mm-hmm. I do think I have enough knowledge. So I don't have as many experiences. Like when I go and read something by, let's just say tactics, you'll write down experiences you had to illustrate your point.
Right.
How would I do that if I lack that kind of experience to illustrate a point?
Okay, the way you do that is you don't write a book about experiences.
Okay.
Notice that tactics is about a way to engage people, and when I tell them a way to engage, then I give them illustrations about how I actually engaged in that way.
Okay.
But when you're writing, if you're writing a basic apologetics, now you're talking about ideas and not about engagements. So what you're going to be looking for is you're going to be looking for language that is going to ways to make the points more accessible, okay? And one of them is with anecdotes. That was tactics. But another one is with illustrations. And I don't mean written, I don't mean drawn illustrations, I mean verbal illustrations. You know, I'm looking at my clock here and I'm just about winding down to the top of the show in another minute, but I want to talk to you some more about this, so I'm going to just leave you on. And we'll pick this up at the top of the hour. I won't do commentary, and then we're done. I'll get to the rest of our callers, all right?
Okay, sounds good.
But the point that I was just making is that, you know, there some of these details are a matter of crafting and the discipline of crafting and you know, how do you get to the particulars that are going to communicate most effectively? And one of those ways is to try to find apt or appropriate illustrations of your point. So when I do the cosmological argument, I have a phrase I use. The Big Bang needs a big banger. Okay,
that's I like that.
That's one form of a cosmological argument, but that's very accessible. It's commonsensible, you know, to people. But this is where, as a writer, you'll be thinking of different ways of characterizing your ideas that will be accessible to the people who are reading. And that's part of the craft. That's part of the hard work of writing. Okay, and I'll talk about the work of writing when we come back after the top of the hour break. But if you can find ways to illustrate by making up a story or a characterization, or especially if you could find a way of saying something that is terse, to the point, but still substantive. Those are called aphorisms.
Like a mousetrap for irreducible complexity, something
like
that.
Yeah, well, that's an illustration. But I'm thinking about, look, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and unto God the things that are God. Or what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul? Notice how we are told to believe, but we're not taught to believe. These are sayings that get right to the heart of the matter. The first two were Jesus. The third one was Mr. Cade from Hibbing, Minnesota. So let me put you on hold, and we'll come back and after the break, and we'll talk together. For the rest of you, callers, hang on, and the rest of you, give them heaven. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason.